We live in the world, which is headed and run by the prince of the power of the air. But we live by the Spirit, discerning the times. For he who is spiritual discerns all things. Sharpen your discernment. Build your faith. Listen to the Word and World Team. Minister the Word of God through conversational theology, piercing the darkness of this present evil age.
Hello, darkness, my old friend. I've come to talk with you again, because a vision softly creeping left its seeds while I was sleeping. And the vision that was planted in my brain still remains within the sound of silence.
Welcome back. This is Hampton Keithley and Bob Brandon, and we're doing our book review of Rodney Stark's How the West Won. How are you today, Bob?
Cold, almost frostbitten, Hampton. It's minus 1 degree.
Yeah, that's
when I was really, walking my dog this morning. Yeah, but you've been playing golf, except yesterday or today.
Yeah, I was in shorts and short sleeves Saturday, actually sweating as I walked the golf course.
Oh, gosh.
And then the cold front blew in Sunday. And so now we have 20s and 30s off for 4 days, and it'll go back to normal.
Well, I couldn't even coach last night. I couldn't get through the canyon. The big semi almost went all the way off the road. When you're in that canyon and you go off to, if you're on the upper level, so he's going westbound.
Mm-hmm.
He almost went down into the eastbound lanes.
Wow. And once you're in the canyon, there's no way to turn around.
Yeah, you can't get out. So what I've learned to do is before I get on the entrance in gypsum, if there are some semis lined up, I just stop and I call and I check all the CDOT stuff. Because once I go down that road, I can't get back.
Right.
So that's what I saw, all the semis lined up yesterday. So I stopped, checked into it, just looked at that picture. I just said, there's no way they're not going to have that done in 3 or 4 hours. There's no way. So Steve covered for me.
That's good. I remember many times getting up at 5 o'clock and heading to town. So for you to coach Kara and Josiah with it being 0 degrees or 8 degrees. I always said the most important thing on my truck was four-wheel drive living up there. And the second most important thing was remote start.
Oh yeah. You heat that thing up before you get in there.
Yeah. Defrost the windows and all that.
Well, are you excited about this morning's podcast?
I am. Me always.
Too. Yeah. This is great material. How about, you're going to drive us through it, but, our habit has been to read from the book of Daniel, because in the book of Daniel, God sets out the historical timeline for all of history. We're going to read about that today. This is Daniel chapter 9, known as, Daniel's prayer, but there's fantastic material here. How about if I get started?
Okay.
Daniel chapter 9. In the first year of Darius, son of Ahasuerus, who was of Median descent and who had been appointed king over the Babylonian Empire, in the first year of his reign, I, Daniel, came to understand from the sacred books that number of years for the fulfilling of the desolation of Jerusalem, which had come as the Lord's message to the prophet Jeremiah, would be 70 years. So I turned my attention to the Lord God to implore him by prayer and requests with fasting, sackcloth, and ashes. I prayed to the Lord my God, confessing in this way. Let me pause there, Hampton, because You know, I'm loath to interrupt the biblical text,
right?
But there were some things there that probably need a little clarification. So to set the table a little bit for that, let's do it this way. Daniel's, you know, been quite a while in Babylon now, you know, like 60 years or so. And his contemporary, Jeremiah, back in Jerusalem, he stayed. He was never exiled to Babylon. Another contemporary of both of theirs, Ezekiel, was exiled, and he's in Babylon. So those three prophets, Daniel, Jeremiah, Ezekiel, overlap quite a bit. Jeremiah was the earliest, but lived quite a while. So anyway, Daniel is reading Jeremiah while he's a captive in Babylon, and he's calling it the sacred books.
Mm-hmm.
So you're familiar with the theological category of canonization, right? And sometimes we think, oh, well, a prophet, you know, wrote a biblical book, and then decades, maybe centuries later, you know, council got together and decided that was scripture. These guys knew it was scripture when it came off the press, so to speak.
That's true.
Right? And you see that in the New Testament, where Peter refers to Paul's writings that way.
Yeah.
So they were, you know, the contemporaries knew. So that's the first thing I wanted to say. The second thing is, Jeremiah's getting the 70 years of captivity from the law of Moses. And in the law, Moses had said, hey, when you guys get in the land, every seventh year, you need to, like, let the land go fallow,
right?
Don't put, and then every 50th year, you know, the year of Jubilee and all that, same kind of issues. They never did that.
Right.
So Jeremiah is looking at that going, okay, well, we're going to be in captivity for 1 year for every time we didn't do that Jubilee thing. And it turns out, right?
Yeah, after what was it, 490 years? They owed God 70 years off.
Right. So you're going to be there 70 years. So they're getting, you know, in a sense, I guess, what I wanted to draw from that. And that's all in like Jeremiah 25, Jeremiah 29. Someday, Hampton, we've got to go into the book of Jeremiah. That's one of the most fascinating books of the scriptures. But regardless, in those chapters, you can tell where Daniel was reading in Jeremiah to come up with that number. So I just wanted to lay that background before we get into his prayer.
Okay.
So back to Daniel chapter 9. Now we're in verse 4. This is his prayer. O Lord, great and awesome God, who is faithful to his covenant with those who love him and keep his commandments. We have sinned. We've done what's wrong and wicked. We've rebelled by turning away from your commandments and standards. We've not paid attention to your servants, the prophets, who spoke by your authority to our kings, our leaders, and our ancestors, and to all the inhabitants of the land as well. You are righteous, O Lord, but we are humiliated this day. The people of Judah and the inhabitants of Jerusalem and all Israel, both near and far away, and all the countries in which you've scattered them, because they've behaved unfaithfully toward you. O Lord, we've been humiliated, our kings, our leaders, our ancestors, because we've sinned against you. Yet the Lord our God is compassionate and forgiving, even though we have rebelled against him. We've not obeyed the Lord our God by living according to his laws that he set before us through his servants, the prophets. All Israel has broken your law and turned away by not obeying you. Therefore, you have poured out on us the judgment solemnly threatened in the law of Moses, servant of God, for we've sinned against you. He's carried out his threats against us and our rulers who were over us by bringing great calamity on us. And what has happened to Jerusalem has never been equaled under all heaven. Just as written in the law of Moses, so all this calamity has come on us. Still, we've not tried to pacify the Lord our God by turning back from our sin and by seeking wisdom from your reliable moral standards. The Lord was mindful of the calamity and he brought it on us. For the Lord our God is just in all he has done, and we've not obeyed him. Now, O Lord our God, who brought your people out of the land of Egypt with great power and made a name for yourself that is remembered to this day, we have sinned and behaved wickedly. O Lord, according to all your justice, please turn your raging anger away from your city, Jerusalem, your holy mountain. For due to our sins and the iniquities of our ancestors, Jerusalem and your people are mocked by all our neighbors. So now, our God, accept the prayer and requests of your servant and show favor to your devastated sanctuary for your own sake. Listen attentively, my God, and hear. Open your eyes and look on our desolated ruins, the city called by your name. For it's not because of our own righteous deeds that we're praying to you, but because your compassion is abundant. O Lord, hear. O Lord, forgive. O Lord, pay attention and act. Don't delay. For your own sake, O my God, for your city and your people are called by your name. While I was still speaking and praying, confessing my sin and the sin of my people Israel, and presenting my requests before the Lord my God concerning his holy mountain. Yes, while I was still praying, the man Gabriel, whom I had seen previously in a vision, was approaching me in my state of extreme weariness around the time of the evening offering. He spoke with me, instructing me as follows, Daniel, I've now come to impart understanding to you. At the beginning of your requests, a message went out. I have come to convey it to you, for you are of great value in God's sight. Therefore, consider the message and understand the vision. 70 weeks have been determined concerning your people and your holy city to put an end to rebellion, to bring sin to completion, to atone for iniquity, to bring in perpetual righteousness, and seal up the prophetic vision, and to anoint a most holy place. So know and understand, from the issuing of the command to restore and rebuild Jerusalem, until an anointed one, a prince, arrives, there will be a period of 7 weeks and 62 weeks. It will again be built with plaza and moat, but in distressful times. Now, after the 62 weeks, an anointed one will be cut off and have nothing. As for the city and the sanctuary, the people of the coming prince will destroy them. But his end will come speedily like a flood until the end of war that has been decreed. There will be destruction. He will confirm a covenant with many for 1 week. But in the middle of that week, he will bring sacrifices and offerings to a halt. On the wing of abominations will come one who destroys, until the decreed end is poured out on the one who destroys. That's Daniel chapter 9, Hampton. What do you think?
Well, rather confusing what all those what all those weeks mean.
A week means seven.
Well, I know it means 7 years, but it's hard to know what the future holds. We're going through Revelation at our church, and I'm getting a different version than the one I grew up with. So it's been interesting to listen to all that.
Huh.
So,
well,
pre-trib, you know, versus all, I guess more all millennial or whatever.
Oh, that's what you're getting.
Yeah.
More, more all mill.
I think.
Yeah. Well, let me just respond briefly, this very briefly, this way. When Jeremiah says 70 years, he's calculating according to, well, under the Lord's inspiration, but according to the law of Moses. That looks pretty literal to me.
Right.
So when the text says in Revelation, numerous times, 1,000 years, that sounds pretty literal to me.
Yeah.
Okay. That's all I want to say.
Well, you want to do Revelation one of these days too, so
I know.
Maybe we got too many things to do.
We do, so we better press on.
Okay. So we're going to do chapter 9 and 10 today. Chapter 9 is industry, trade, and technology. And I always like to read his first little introduction.
Yeah, it's great.
So I'm going to do that. It says, there is a growing illusion fostered by an assortment of revisionist scholars that Europe's industrial and technological lead over the rest of the world developed only recently, having come out of nowhere at the end of the 18th or even as late as the 19th century. Some even claim that the West stole it all from Asia, which supposes that Asia was already industrialized before a sudden decline into backwardness. So, yeah, that would be kind of hard to explain. If they had all that industry, what happened?
So
it may well be true, as these revisionists claim, that the total value of what was being traded in China during, say, the 16th century was greater than that of European trade. But that difference reflects only a greater volume based on a larger population. It tells us nothing about how the trade goods were created or about the technological merits of what was being bought and sold. Eyeglasses, for example, were being sold only in Europe at this time and in large quantities there, but 100 pounds of rice outweighed and may well have cost more than a pair of eyeglasses. In any event, despite the fact that these matters are being solemnly debated in academia, no serious reader needs me to refute such nonsense.
Okay, so well, that's what I love it when he says things like that. And my other favorite is when he says, not so.
Yes.
But it raises a question for me that I want to raise to our audience. Why do modern scholars, you know, some of them, obviously Stark's an exception, but why do they misread this stuff? Why are they championing the East, like China, India, Asia, and the Muslims over the Western dominance? Why are they doing that?
Well, are you asking me?
I am.
Okay. I think because at all costs, we have to get rid of Christianity. And Christianity was what, you know, was driving Western civilization for the most part.
That's right. And they also, within that, I think that's the overarching reason. And within that big umbrella, then, they like dominant, like top-down governments. They like dictatorships, right? They like communism, even though it's been capitalism and democracy that lifted the West far above the rest of the world. They like the heavy hand. They think they're going to be part of that when it takes over. And it's well on its way to taking over, right?
Yeah.
So I think that's why they do it. Remember, everybody's got a worldview, whether they think through it or not. And the first thing a person will do, according to J.A. Schumpeter, for their worldview is lie. Now, in the Christian worldview, that's not the case. because you're told explicitly, don't lie. And you have no reason to, right? It's your beliefs that have triumphed down through the ages. There's no reason to lie. But a faulty worldview, the first thing a person will do for it is lie. So let me read just real quickly a sentence from earlier in Stark about capitalism. Because that plays, you know, capitalism can only flourish under a Christian kind of paradigm. So let me just read the definition of that. I want us to always keep this front and center. As Stark defines it, capitalism is an economic system wherein privately owned, relatively well-organized, and stable firms pursue complex commercial activities within a relatively free, that is, unregulated market, taking a systematic long-term approach to investing and reinvesting wealth in productive activities involving a hired workforce and guided by anticipated and actual returns. So thanks for letting me interrupt you there.
Very good. He goes on to say the reality is that medieval Europe saw the rise of banking, elaborate manufacturing networks, rapid innovations in technology and finance, and a busy network of trading cities. Also evident in this period were the first stirrings of what eventually became the Industrial Revolution. Europe had long been ahead of the rest of the world in technology, but by the end of the 16th century, that gap had become a chasm. Consider military capabilities. Europe's 16th century navies consisted of large, heavily armed, sophisticated sailing ships that could go anywhere and sink anything. Only in European armies did the rank and file bear firearms, and were they backed up by maneuverable field artillery. In addition to this huge technological superiority, were the tactical and training advantages that had favored the West since the days of ancient Greece. Those advantages would continue to favor the West for centuries. In fact, as late as 1900, after the Chinese army was fully equipped with modern firearms and artillery imported from the West, 409 Western soldiers, armed only with rifles, pistols, three machine guns with very little ammunition, and a homemade cannon, withstood the Imperial Army's 55-day attack on the embassy compound in Peking, holding off thousands of Imperial forces. The Western troops suffered casualties of nearly 50%, but still stood firm. And military technology was just beginning. So he talks next about capitalism moves north, and what he was describing in that section was this repressive weavers guild that they had in Flanders, where they paid off the local rulers to, you know, stay out of it and to support them. And they set the wages, they limited competition, they set high prices, and all of that limited production because there was no motivation.
Go ahead. I'm sorry.
But,
I'm sorry.
You know, I couldn't, you know, big business was paying off politicians. That's been going on a long time.
So I was going to say, you know, one of my favorite hobby horses is the main issue I think we're facing in our culture the last couple of years, and will continue for a while, all the COVID stuff. Just so people know, this is not, trust me, I'm not going to go into a diatribe right now, but just a little tidbit. So the NIH, the FDA, all the, you know, NIAID, all that, those governing agencies that are supposed to regulate the pharmaceutical companies. Do you know where they get their money? Like who funds the NIAID? Who funds the NIH? Who funds the FDA?
Pharmaceutical companies?
Primarily pharmaceutical companies. The very companies they're supposed to regulate funds them. So how much regulation is really going on?
Right.
So go ahead.
So the Italian bankers lured the unhappy cloth makers to Italy with the promises of no tolls or customs and even no personal taxes. And so a lot of them left and went down there, and a large weaving industry sprang up. And then they exported their products back to Flanders because they were more productive. And so their products were cheaper and kind of forced the Flanders guilds to change the rules. And while that's going on in Italy and Flanders, the merchants in England were building a really good wool manufacturing process. And so he goes into the English capitalism. And I'm just going to read one of these paragraphs. It says, secure behind the channel, the English had become one of the major Western powers, blessed with exceptionally productive agriculture, vast mineral resources, and abundant water power. So it was only a matter of time before they went into business for themselves, imposing unfavorable taxes and duties on foreign firms and products. Even so, it was the remarkable rise of political freedom that gave greater impetus to English capitalism. As made explicit in the Magna Carta, the English merchant enjoyed secure property rights and free markets, unlike early capitalists in southern Italy and those in the Walloon area of Flanders, who were destroyed by despots. Freedom and the security of property spurred innovation, with the result that English industries developed or exploited technologies far superior to those used by their European competitors. When the Industrial Revolution began in the 18th century, it was not a revolution at all, but part of an evolution of invention and innovation that had begun in England, perhaps as early as the 11th century. So we keep seeing this: secure property rights, free markets, political freedom, you know.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Yes. And that's what enables, you know, it's that concept that enables the ideas to flourish.
Yeah.
So I love that.
And he has a section on the wool manufacturing, and he goes into great detail about the fulling process. I didn't know this is part of the making of wool fabric, but you soak it and then you beat it with a hammer. And it takes a long time and it's, you know, hard to do. And so what they did was the English developed these fulling mills, and they built them along the rivers, and they would harness the power of the flowing water to get the cloth wet and to turn the hammers that beat the cloth. And so they ended up being able to produce way faster and much better quality than the people on the continent.
Yeah, so they could sell it abroad too. People wanted, you know, the wealthy people wanted the British stuff.
Right. So here's a rabbit trail. Did you ever drive around with your family in the 70s and stop at a hotel that had a free continental breakfast?
No.
No?
No, but we did what you're talking about. Yeah, we traveled around. I don't remember a
free... You don't remember the free continental breakfast?
No. Today, I get
them. They called it the continental breakfast?
No.
So I'm driving... we went across the English Channel on a barge, had my car, and we approached England, and I went, look at those white cliffs. And then, you know, I was like, oh, yeah, the White Cliffs of Dover. And we landed and drove into Canterbury and stayed at a bed and breakfast. And the lady said, would you like the full English breakfast tomorrow? And I'm like, I guess so. And it was eggs and bacon and tomatoes. And then the light came on for me that for the previous couple years driving around the continent, all they had for breakfast was brochins, you know, rolls and things like that.
I see.
And I didn't realize that the continental breakfast was named that at Holiday Inn in the 70s because of that's how they ate on the continent.
I see. So the skimmed down version.
Yeah, and I've asked a lot of people, do you know where we get that word continental breakfast? That don't very often have anybody that knows.
So it's,
and
it's
I didn't know till I got the full English breakfast in England.
Well, there you go. Very good. So, you anyway. Could be a coach. You could be a coach, Hampton, telling your swimmers trivia questions.
There you go. You can use that one on your next trivia question.
Okay.
let's see, what's coal power? He talked about the decentralization of the industry. And so people moved out to the country to be near the rivers that could power their mills. And the other technological advancement that he talked about was coal power. And they switched to burning coal instead of wood, and it burns hotter so they could make stronger metal items like cannons.
Mm-hmm.
And so then they had to get into mining to get the coal. And I guess that's when they invented the rails to help the heavy wagons full of coal get out of the mines. And then the pump, they had to invent pumps to get the water out of the mines. So there was a lot of innovation that came along with that.
Yeah, a lot of technological innovation that really follows on the heels of capitalism with its freedoms. So, right. But so that brings something to my mind that I'd like to spend just a little bit of time reading from the scripture, because, you know, he went in just a little bit into mining and mm-hmm. the technological advances there and resulting from that. So I wanted to read some of chapter 28 in the book of Job, because the subject is mining. And they're talking about mining because at that time, it's the epitome of human technology. Now, I'm not even sure when Job was written. Many think it was, in a sense, the first book of the Bible written. You know, yeah, Moses, right?
I've heard that.
Yeah. So Moses was about 1450 to 1400, you know, in there. So Genesis was written by Moses, you know, about that time. Now, the events that Genesis covers, obviously, is the beginning. But when it was written was about 1450 or so. But Job, who knows when that was written? So here's Job chapter 28. Surely there is a mine for silver, and a place where gold is refined. Iron is taken from the ground, and rock is poured out as copper. Man puts an end to the darkness. He searches the farthest recesses for the one in the deepest dark, for the ore in the deepest darkness. Far from where people live, he sinks a shaft in places travelers have long forgotten. Far from other people, he dangles and sways. The earth from which food comes is overturned below as though by fire. A place whose stores are sapphires and which contains dust of gold. A hidden path no bird of prey knows. No falcon's eye has spotted it. Proud beasts have not set foot on it, and no lion has passed along it. On the flinty rock, man has set to work with his hand. He has overturned mountains at their bases. He has cut out channels through the rocks, and his eyes have spotted every precious thing. He has searched the sources of the rivers, and what was hidden, he has brought into the light. So isn't that fascinating that long ago, mining was the epitome of technology?
Mm-hmm.
And so it shows man's glory, right? Finding the things God has hidden in the earth. And then the next section, and we're not going to read the entire thing, but it starts out like this. So that was the first 11 verses of Job 28, verse 12. But wisdom, where can it be found? Where's the place of understanding? Mankind doesn't know its place. It cannot be found in the land of the living. So anyway, you know, it goes on to elaborate that point that mankind's wisdom demonstrated in technology, it can only do so much. What you need on top of that is the wisdom from above, you know, how to administrate things as God would have it, not just how to technologically advance. And it isn't that, in a sense, Hampton, what we're reading in Stark.
Mm-hmm.
That what the West really had, they had the technology, but they only had the technology because they had the deeper wisdom to run things in a capitalist way. with its freedoms, right? Which accentuates the glory of mankind, right? The image of God. So anyway, I just thought it was fascinating that you see these same concepts in the scriptures themselves that Stark's elucidating. So thanks for that diversion.
No problem. Okay, next is the Hanseatic League. And this was an association of merchants from all over Europe. And basically, it just resulted in various nations specializing. For example, the, I guess, Flanders focused on making wool, and then they bought most everything else they needed from other places. Sweden was the source for all those 100-plus foot tall sailing masts used all over Europe in their larger ships. And so the English actually got most of their longbow staves from Eastern Europe, and all of that's going on in the 13th century, the specialization. And then there, the next thing was about Asian enterprises, and there was quite a bit of trade going on in the 1200s. And that's where the Marco Polo comes in. Chinese silk was so much cheaper than Italian silk that it was worth it to take a caravan over the, what they called the Silk Road, because they hauled so much silk over that road, I guess. But they would go and get that and then bring it back. But then, remember our Black Death in the middle of the 1300s.
Right.
That, and then Muslims conquering Armenia, and the Ming Dynasty taking over from, I guess, was Kublai Khan. And they despised foreigners and kind of ended the trade. So that all ended in the 1300s.
Right.
And then he talks about Europe's superior technology. And he said it should be noted that Marco Polo's reports of the glories of China were concerned with such things as the splendor and wealth of Kublai Khan's palaces, grand public works, and the fertility of Chinese fields and orchards. It was not an account of technological marvels. And with good reason, the most remarkable technological progress in that era was occurring in Europe. From 1200 through 1500, European technology was rapidly improving in such critical areas as metallurgy, ships, and armaments. These improvements allowed the West to greatly increase its lead over the rest of the world.
Yeah, right.
And one of those things was the blast furnace. And he says, perhaps the single most important technological breakthrough of medieval times was the blast furnace, which made it possible to cheaply produce large amounts of superior iron, and therefore better cannons, better firearms, better plowshares, better tools of all sorts. And blast furnaces are so called because they introduce blasts of air into the furnace box to increase the heat of the coals, which results in superior iron. Like so many other inventions, blast furnaces are said to have been first developed in China, but once again, being first had little lasting importance. Recall from chapter one how the Chinese court destroyed the iron industry that had briefly flourished during the 11th century. In any event, the first blast furnaces in Europe seems to have appeared in Sweden in 1150. And there is no evidence to suggest that the Vikings learned the technique from the Chinese. The technology of blast furnaces spread rapidly from Sweden all across Europe, eventuating in a major industrial complex in England.
Yeah, that's interesting to me because, you know, in that chapter we read in Job about mining, that talked about iron.
Right.
You know, way before any of this stuff. So yeah. I wonder when.
When did we lose the ability to make iron?
Yeah, there you go. Yeah. But his point, you know, he keeps making the same point, which is great. It's not that mankind can't invent this stuff. You could be in China and discover it, but it's the system of government that allows that discovery to flourish or not. Right. And China's repressive. So it never flourished there. They have the intelligent people. They just don't have the system that promotes development.
Right. His next section is about carracks and galleons. And those are just types of ships they developed in Europe. And basically, they were just large and could sail across the ocean.
Yeah.
And in combination with the next section on artillery and firearms, the development of those made the ships more powerful and invincible.
Some of them huge, right? When they give the dimensions of some of them. You know, like 60 yards or more.
Right.
Three levels. Oh, my gosh.
Well, there was the first paragraph in his artillery and firearms I thought was interesting. There is a learned debate over whether gunpowder was brought to the West from China or invented independently in Europe. Here we go again. You know, everything's from China. The great scholastic scholar Roger Bacon published a formula for gunpowder in a cryptogram in 1242 and then openly in his Opus Tertium in 1267. Albertus Magnus, who we also read about last chapter, Bacon's colleague at the University of Paris, included an effective recipe for gunpowder in a manuscript dated 1270. Whatever the origins of the West's knowledge of gunpowder, the Chinese had gunpowder at about the same time or slightly before it appeared in Europe, but they made very little use of it. They built some cannons, but soon seemed content to use gunpowder for fireworks, which were used primarily to scare away evil spirits. I thought that was really interesting.
Yeah, they don't have the worldview to take advantage of this stuff.
Right. So the point of the end here was the building of these larger ships armed with cannons made them prime to go discover the world.
Yeah, they ruled that they could rule the ocean. And even when I say it that way, Hampton, you know what echoes in my mind is Genesis 1:26, right? Let us make mankind in our image. Let him rule the earth. And so you see the dominion of mankind spreading through the Western developments, not the East. Not the East. And where, and by the way, when Adam and Eve were kicked out of Eden, what direction did they have to go?
East.
East. The kicked out direction. The flourishing direction would be to the West. Okay.
Okay. So next one is chapter 10, Discovering the World. Just the first paragraph. One of the most significant steps toward modernism came with the dawning of the Age of Discovery. Europeans had long wanted a secure sea route to Asia, but now they had the ships and navigational technology equal to the task.
Yeah, so this chapter, you know, is fascinating, but, you know, it really describes man's dominion of the sea.
Yeah, you know, from a historical standpoint, I found it interesting. Right. I'm a history major, so I enjoyed it. But the navigational, I'm jumping down to the navigational technology section. And he says the first major achievement was the magnetic compass. Like so many other medieval inventions, the magnetic compass is generally attributed to the Chinese. The Chinese may have been the first to discover that a magnetized needle floating in liquid points north, but the Chinese found this phenomenon to be of interest primarily for performing magical rites. They may not have used this device aboard ships until long after Europeans were doing so. Moreover, there's no reason to believe that the knowledge that a floating magnetized needle points north reached Europe from China. And it said Europeans were the first to place a circular card directly beneath the magnetized compass needle, marked off into a 32-point scale with north at zero. And this not only allowed mariners to know which way was north, but also enabled them to set an accurate course in any direction expressed in points from north. Helmsman, hold steady at 24 points. Such a course could be followed even in the dark and without any need for landmarks. The first recorded use of a compass in the West was in 1187. But it'd probably been in use before that. And the next thing they developed was the astrolabe. And so they could determine your latitude from, you know, major heavenly bodies.
Yeah.
And
and how about the knots? What is a knot? What is a knot?
I think that's something you learn from Huckleberry Finn or one of the Mark Twain books. You throw the board in the water and you have another rope with knots, and however fast it passes the knots in a minute or something is how they, you know, they we're going six knots.
Yeah, determine their speed. Yeah. So it's their unit of measurement, and it literally is a knot tied in a rope.
Right.
Well, a series of them that they
and
drag.
It's still used today.
Today, right? That's what you hear. You know, but you don't say, "Oh, my boat can go." Well, we do say it. We say it can go 50 miles an hour. But I mean, if you're talking to a seafaring guy, they don't use that language. They say how many knots their ship can go.
It's kind of like me talking with my friend in Canada, and he tells me the temperature in Celsius. And I'm like,
what is that?
Okay, what does that mean?
Yeah, I don't know if that's hot or cold.
So we talked about Portugal, the rise of Portugal, and the sailors discovered the Madeira Islands and the Azores. And, you know, Stark said that the Portuguese shipped cattle to the Azores to resupply ships sailing across the Atlantic. And I just went on Google Maps and looked up where these things were.
I didn't have
any idea, really.
Yeah, off Africa there, the west coast of Africa.
The vastness of the ocean and the size of these little islands, it made me amazed that
they could find
guys
them.
Could find them when they wanted to, you know, go back across or come back the other direction.
Yeah.
And the reason I bring that up is because, do you remember the book Unbroken about Louis Zamperini? Laura Hildenbrand wrote that book.
No.
She wrote a book of what's the racehorse?
Yeah, Seabiscuit. She wrote that one.
Yeah, she wrote that, which was a bestseller in a movie. And then she wrote Unbroken, which was a bestseller in a movie. And I didn't go back and look this up, but if I remember correctly, I think it was something like 70% of the planes that went down during World War II were not shot down in battle. They got lost and ran out of gas and crashed in the ocean.
Wow.
And I just thought, if our pilots in the 1940s couldn't find Hawaii or whatever island it was they were looking for.
From that point of view, from up in
from,
the sky.
Yeah, from, you know, a mile up where you could see a long way, you know. What does that say about, you know, the navigational skills of these guys in the 1400s?
Yeah, mind-blowing.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's a great point.
So, and then he talks about Vasco da Gama goes around Africa and makes it to India. Seems like, see if I had something here to read. Says, after nearly a year at sea on May 20th, 1498, da Gama landed near Calicut, India. He was not well received by the king. Although a Hindu, the king was influenced by Muslim merchants who may have regarded da Gama as a rival. Little did they know. Still, da Gama had gained valuable cargo by plundering Muslim ships along the way. When he sailed for home on August 29th, his cargo was worth 60 times the cost of the expedition, including the construction of the ships.
Yeah, profitable.
Yeah.
Yeah. You know what, though, Hampton? It brings to my mind one of the difficulties in laying out or ordering history. Because obviously he's not going to go into this, but it is not terribly uncommon to in generations past find Roman coins in the East Coast of America. So there were people coming over here way before what Stark's talking about.
Right
in Michigan, the Phoenicians had copper mines. I mean, you know, it's kind of interesting to think about that stuff, but it just doesn't fit anybody's major paradigm, historical paradigm. So it doesn't get talked about, but mm-hmm. that evidence is there.
Interesting.
Yeah.
The last section is Columbus sails.
What was his name? What was his actual name?
Cristobal Colon.
Cristobal Colon. There you go. Very good.
While Portuguese explored Africa and India, amazing things were happening on the Atlantic. In 1485, Cristobal Colon, as Christopher Columbus was known, and as he signed his name, asked King John II of Portugal to finance his plan to sail west to the Indies. Supported by his advisors, the king turned him down. The Portuguese did so not because they thought the world was flat, as all the textbooks used to claim, but because they correctly believed that Columbus was badly underestimating the circumference of the globe. They believed the voyage would be impossible without stops to resupply. Despite misjudging the distance, Columbus had done a great deal of research in preparation for a voyage west. Having taught himself Latin, he read many great works on astronomy and geography, including Ptolemy's Almagest and Cardinal Pierre d'Ailly's Image of the World. We know this because, as the historian Samuel Eliot Morison wrote,
Well, he says, while you're looking for that, he says, fortunately, we have his own copies of these works,
right,
amply underlined, and their margins are filled with his commentaries.
Yeah. Columbus had also gained invaluable knowledge by voyaging down the west coast of Africa with Portuguese traders. In 1476, he sailed with a Genoese convoy that visited Bristol, England, Galway, Ireland, and possibly Iceland. Somewhere along the line, he seems to have learned about the trade winds, which I thought was fascinating, the somewhat circular prevailing wind system over the Atlantic. On his first voyage to America, he sailed along southern latitudes, where winds blowing from the east propelled him in 5 weeks from the Canaries to the Bahamas. For his return voyage, instead of clawing his way back against those easterly winds, he sailed up to the northern latitudes and was propelled home by prevailing winds from the west, which, as they approach Europe, bend the south toward Portugal and Spain.
Yeah.
The fact that they understood that that existed, you know.
Yeah. Yeah, it's fascinating. And how about, so when it says, you know, America, just another trivia, I'm repeating this so I can ask the kids this. Well, where did that continent, North and South America, get that name?
From Amerigo Vespucci.
Very good, Hampton.
Well, I did read the chapter.
Very good.
Columbus never made it to America, I guess.
To the
sounded
U.S.
to me like all he ever did.
To the
did
U.S., you mean?
To the...
Yeah.
I mean, he made it to all these Caribbean islands.
Well, how'd they get their names?
Yeah, well, I'm going to read that. In these politically correct times, many deny that the Caribs or any other native people were cannibals, claiming that Columbus and his companions made it all up. I will refute this nonsense in detail at the end of chapter 11. Here, it is sufficient to note that the Caribs themselves were colonialists, having invaded the islands from the Orinoco River area of South America in the 13th century. They dined not on one another, but on the less ferocious tribes over whom they ruled. And I guess the word Carib means cannibal. And so that's where we get the Caribbean islands, or Caribbean islands, however you pronounce it.
Yeah. Boy, have you ever been down there? This is a rabbit trail, but
you have been in? The pictures look nice.
I mean, that water, and it's warm. You know, quite often you'll be in 84 degree water. And it's just so
that's
clear.
Like swimming in the big part of the hot springs there in Glenwood.
Yeah. And it's so clear. Oh my gosh. It is a paradise geographically. You know, to me, it would get boring because there's no variation, but I'd be willing to spend a month down there.
Especially in February.
Yeah. Once a year, go down there and just hang out in that beautiful ocean where you can see clearer than a pool.
Yeah.
Oh, it's fantastic.
Well, I think it's interesting and not a coincidence that about the same time, a guy named Martin Luther is nailing his 95 theses on that church door in Wittenberg, and that you know, the Protestant Reformation is kicking off, and the persecuted Christians are now going to have a place to go and have religious freedom.
Yeah, they're going to make great use of that.
Yeah.
How about this little section where he says, it is worth noting that the Columbus story illustrates the importance of political disunity for European progress. Had all of Europe been ruled by an emperor, one rejection would have meant that Columbus would never have sailed west. Just as the emperor of China beached Zheng He's fleet and halted all further voyaging only 50 years before Columbus set sail. Instead, Columbus was able to make his case to several courts, and competition among them seems to have influenced Queen Isabella to change her mind. Clearly, too, competition continued to play a major role in sustaining Europe's Atlantic explorations.
Yeah, I actually had that highlighted, too. That was good. Well, the last, I think I'm going to read the last couple paragraphs of this chapter. As the 16th century began, Europeans continued to believe that the voyages to the West had reached the Indies, even if they had not yet found a mainland resembling China. Then came voyages by the superb navigator and cartographer Amerigo Vespucci. During two or possibly four voyages from about 1499 through perhaps 1504, Vespucci sailed so far down the coast of South America that he realized this was no group of islands off the coast of China, but a huge new continent. After his last voyage, King Ferdinand appointed Vespucci as chief navigator of Spain, responsible for authorizing and planning voyages to the New World. Vespucci also publicized his conclusions about a new continent and sketches of the coast he had sailed along, which led the great mapmaker Martin Waldseemüller to name this new continent America on the world map he published in 1507. Had Columbus hit either of the continents rather than arriving in the Caribbean, and had he been willing to draw the proper conclusion, the New World might have been named Columbia.
Yeah, interesting.
Three decades from 1490 through 1520 changed the world. In 1490, no one knew there were two huge continents located only about 3,500 miles west of Europe. By the end of 1520, Ferdinand Magellan's expedition, financed by Charles V of Spain, had reached the Pacific on its own voyage around the globe. The age of discovery ushered in conquest and colonization and the dawn of modernity.
Yeah, it's so interesting, and I'm so glad you let me read Daniel, you know, as we begin these chapters in Stark, because, you know, as Stark would see it, you know, this is the history of man, right? The discovery of these new continents, the technology that's involved, the capitalist system, and so on. And yet, when we read Daniel, right, 77s have been decreed for the end of sin. The right, you know, the biblical perspective is so much deeper. So in other words, you know, what we're reading in Stark is accurate, I believe, and important for our development of our own, you know, understanding of history and so on. But to study that without the study of the scriptures, to me, is meaningless, right? It won't lead you to the end that God's bringing everything to. Only God will lead us to the end. But and that's why I know this is not where we intended to go, but why I get so disappointed when Christian education, especially at like the high school level, when someone, you know, quote, goes to a Christian high school, they don't teach this stuff that way. They don't teach history underneath the umbrella of God's historical pattern and the future he's declared, right? They don't inform all their subjects by the Bible. They just call, oh, we pray before we have a basketball game. And they could call that Christian education.
There you go. Well, you can see why they canceled Western civilization courses in all the colleges across America. They're trying to brainwash you into one world government.
That's right.
Well, very good. I guess that's it for today. We'll talk to you next time.
Thank you, Hampton.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Therefore, I exhort you, brothers and sisters, by the mercies of God, to present your bodies as a sacrifice, alive, holy, and pleasing to God, which is your reasonable service. Do not be conformed to this present world, but be transformed by the renewing of your mind, so that you may test and approve what is the will of God, what is good and well-pleasing and perfect.